Little roller up along first. Behind the bag. It gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it.
When you think of the 86 Mets, that is the moment you almost always think of. Mookie Wilson's grounder nutmegging Bill Buckner to win Game 6 of the World Series. But there is so much more to this team and that season and their city, all of which collided in a decade defined by utter excess. The 80s. Today, the filmmaker behind the latest 30 for 30, Once Upon a Time in Queens, takes us back in time and behind the scenes of a team that lived just as hard as they played. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, September 14th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Nick Davis, I watched your four-part documentary, Once Upon a Time in Queens. It is debuting over two evenings, tonight and tomorrow on ESPN. It's the new 30 for 30. And the thing that I was struck by about your story here about the 1986 Mets is how much of a character the city of New York is. And I know you're a native New Yorker. I am a native New Yorker, but I was born in 1985. So I could not get enough of the city as you captured it. I'm curious why it was so important to you that you did it in that way.
Well, I think the thing that always struck me about this team was that they captured the spirit of the city as well as any sports team I can imagine. It wasn't just that the city fell in love with the team, which happens all over the place, but the way the team came together and the rollicking, wild, crazy, dangerous energy on that team mirrored the city in the 80s. Mm. And that was always the goal of the film, was to talk about how the team and the city were fused and became one. You know, you think about the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, great team, lots of wonderful personalities, but you don't associate them with Cincinnati in the mid-70s the way you do the 1986 Mets with New York City.
Right. And Nick, I have no working memory of our city at that time. But what's interesting to me here is that you don't begin your film there. You actually start it earlier. You start this whole thing in 1977. You started on July 14th, the day after the blackout, this terrifying, notorious, chaotic time in the city's history.
Our big story on Eyewitness News is the live picture you see directly behind me. Suddenly, light and brightness out of a 24-hour darkness. The bright patchwork of the second night of the great New York energy crisis of 1977.
There was looting. It was all kind of apocalyptic. Nick, why did you choose to start things there?
Because that was the nadir for the city and for the franchise. The summer of 77 was just, the city was in the toilet, the team was in the toilet, and it felt like the rise from the ashes of that moment to the crowning victory in 1986 was the best way to tell the story. And because as the city emerged from the malaise of the 70s, Ford to City, Drop Dead, The Blackout, Son of Sam, all that stuff in the 70s, as the city seemed to get better, the Mets got better. As someone in the film says, Joe Petruccio, I'm not sure that the Mets had anything to do with it, but it did seem like they were coming together as one as the 80s went along. And the thing is, it's not like in the 80s everything was perfect. Far from it. There were a lot of problems, but they were being swept under the rug. So there was this sheen of the 80s, the glamour, the glitz, nightclubs, obviously cocaine and wildness and all that stuff that the 86 Mets exemplified. But underneath it were these real social problems that still have remained to this day. But there was just this glorious winning energy about the city in 1986. And that's what I wanted the film to capture.
Yeah, so this sheen of the 80s, that idea that beneath that was darkness, but up on top it was Wall Street, it was yuppie culture, it was everything. How did those social problems, the ones lurking underneath there, how did those manifest on the Mets?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, that sort of money thing on top of the 80s. But underneath, there were all these problems going on. There were the drug problems that we didn't know about, and especially in 86. You know, Dwight Gooden became an active drug user in 1986. Other players were doing, you know, things they shouldn't be doing. There were race problems on the team and in the city that were being swept under the rug. And so all these things were bubbling up underneath the surface. And the question as the summer went along was, is that going to derail what seems to be an inevitable championship? They were so good. They were so talented and so smart and brilliant about baseball, which is actually one thing I didn't realize at the time. It's just how smart they were about baseball. As a fan, you just think, well, they show up, they play, they're better than everybody. Of course they win. But they really knew what they were doing.
On that, Nick, I'm curious because, of course, you know, coming into this thing, I've heard the tales of debauchery, the tales of darkness, but the intelligence, what opened your eyes to that in your reporting and in your making of the film?
They were so smart about hitting and pitching and defense and strategy. I mean, Lenny Dykstra, say what you will about him, he's a baseball savant. That just caught me off guard. I just didn't realize that so much intelligence went into what they were doing. And they were so smart also about the chemistry of the team and about their desire to win. You know, when you're on a winning team and you're on a team where winning is the focus, that it's different from other teams. You know, Bobby Ojeda talked to us about being on the Red Sox in 83, 84, 85. He didn't experience that until he got to the Mets in 86. And it was like, these guys, it's all about winning. If you go 3-for-4 and we lose and you're happy about it, someone's going to punch you in the face.
So the punching of faces, the characters that you interview. I mean, Nick, how many characters, how many people did you interview for this film? Because I was staggered in watching this. Just how many faces popped up with accents that I honestly just wanted even more of?
We did 44 interviews in all, probably about 14 members of the 1986 Mets, and then 30 assorted writers, managers, commentators, you know, Joe McElvain, executives, broadcasters, and then, you know, celebrities, people who meant something in New York at that time. Cyndi Lauper, Oliver Stone, Mike Tyson.
Cyndi Lauper, man, I gotta say, I guess I should have known that she was from Queens and sounded like Queens, but I was pretty blown yeah. away by her appearance in this.
Yeah. Yeah. She had a really wonderful Queens accent. And that was what we really wanted to do. You know, if it's not being told by the actual participants, the players, told by New Yorkers, told by people who lived it and were there. You know, Chuck D, who was cutting his first album that summer, you know, he was there and obsessed with the Mets in 86 and 84, 85. Like he saw the whole thing come together as a true Mets fan. And so it made perfect sense to have people like him, John McEnroe, tell the story. It was such a thrill. And to weave those guys in, George R.R. Martin,
yes.
who's a huge Mets fan. You know,
so many Game of Thrones fans, Nick, are going to watch this and think to themselves, wait a minute, this dude can sit for Nick Davis in a 4-part documentary, but not give us the next book.
Well, he's very busy, but he took time out of his busy schedule to talk the Mets. As he said, unfortunately, we weren't able to work this line in. He said, "For my sins, I am a Mets fan," which I just think is a great line. These guys really bleed. You know, you know, when you're a fan of a particular team, they get into your blood. And so if someone wants to talk to you about them, even if it's 35 years later, you're happy to do so.
Yes. Look, the Yankees got into my blood. So I came to this with a certain condescension. Nick, anybody who works on this show understands that. But I was won over. And again, I'm won over by complicated characters in this because Lenny Dykstra is not a person that I feel comfortable liking.
Right.
But listening to him talk to you.
See, baseball is a game of failure. You either fail or succeed. Get a hit and everybody throws you a high five or you're making out. Who cares? You make it out. They don't remember the guy made out.
I'm like, yeah, I get it. I get there's a charisma in his madness.
That's what I hope, you know, people take from the film. And it's not obviously just for Mets fans or even just for baseball fans. It's about these characters, these personalities. And that's part of what made the team so amazing and memorable is they were larger than life personalities who still have so much charisma. Lenny and Keith and Daryl and Doc and obviously Gary Carter, who we weren't able to interview, sadly. You know, Ray Knight, Mookie, Ron. Kevin Mitchell, Ron Darling, all these guys had so much personality and so much character that the story is about them. It's a story about these people who came together for a common goal and for one great moment were able to fulfill what they thought was their destiny.
So if the Yankees, Nick, they're the stuffed suits, they're old money, they're Monument Park, I get all of that. What were the Mets in contrast for those uninitiated into the culture of New York here? Why did they appeal, do you think, to so many people in the city at that particular time?
Well, the history of the city is as a National League town, and the Dodgers and Giants leave town in 57, forming an enormous void in the city's heart. So the Mets inherited all those fans and then, you know, were terrible, but bumbling and lovable and kind of were the team of the people. And when they win in 69, that just cements it, this miracle. So they're of the people and they have this sort of magic now baked into the DNA so that when they rise up and are good again in the 80s, the city embraced them and it became again a National League town. I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but the fact is, from 64 on, it was mostly a Met town. For 21 out of 29 years, they outdrew the Yankees. Mm. Other than the period when the Yankees were winning in the late 70s, it really was a Mets town. The idea that many people think of today as, well, there's a little brother, it's a Yankee town, that really didn't take hold until the mid-90s when the franchise fell into real disrepair in the ownership. And the Yankees started winning all the time again. Again, I'm not speaking as the filmmaker now. I'm speaking as a Mets fan.
No, Nick, I appreciate you standing atop the soapbox you said you would not climb on. I do appreciate that. Continue.
Sorry. You know, but I think a lot of Mets fans feel like with the new ownership, things are going to be restored to their rightful place. If not this year, certainly next year and the years following.
All right, Nick, coming up, I want to dive deep into the year 1986.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So it's 1986 now, Nick, and after 85, which went well for the Mets, expectations were already pretty high, but then Davey Johnson, the manager of this team, he does something that makes them even higher. So what happened and how did that shape and set up, really, how this team would come to be known?
Well, you know, managers are traditionally very kind of PC about talking to the press and stuff. But they came in and asked Davey Johnson, what do you think about this year? And he said, we're going to dominate.
As a manager, you're asked questions all the time. What do you believe? You know, when I first got there, I said, you know, we can compete in 84 and in 85. We're better. Now we're going to dominate.
And that set the tone. Everybody on the team, to a man, like, agreed, yes, we have by far the best talent and we're going to dominate this league. And then they went out and did it. Putting a bullseye on your own back and then going out and winning 108 games, it's kind of remarkable. And they did have all of these things happen during the season that could have sort of derailed them. You know, Mookie went down in spring training, the ball was thrown into his eye, but they had such depth of talent and character that when Mookie goes down, it creates, you know, a starting job for Lenny Dykstra. Kevin Mitchell is therefore able to make the roster as a rookie. They never missed a beat, no matter what happened.
Yeah, look, when you talk to these characters, these human beings who feel like movie characters, it feels like, you know, Keith Hernandez, for instance. Did you expect him, Nick, to be as open and honest with you about his relationship with his dad?
No.
remarkably frank about that in a way that made me almost uncomfortable, how comfortable he was talking about it, relatively speaking.
Yeah, his relationship with his father is so complex and intricate as he describes it. He loves his father and his father loved him, obviously, but there was this sort of overbearing pressure to succeed. And, you know, Keith grew up with his dad as his little league coach, but the problems came, as Keith says, when he got into high school, and then he gets other coaches. And it's like if the coach disagrees with what his father is telling him, and he's going back into Davey Johnson's office to call his dad after every at bat.
After every at bat, he's calling his dad.
And, you know, his father would say, look, you've closed your stance. I can no longer see the numbers. I used to be able to see the numbers on your back. You know, all these little things that his dad was picking up on. And in the summer of 86, Keith was slumping.
And dad said, Keith, you know, you're not going to come out of your slump. I know what you're doing wrong.
I screamed at my dad and dropped every bomb on him and told him to go in your hat and blah, blah, blah. And I hung up on him. Oh, my God. That was probably our worst argument. So we didn't talk all summer.
So, no, I was not prepared for that level of openness. All of them really were so open about, you know, their lives, you know, Daryl and his father,
yeah.
And Dwight with his backstory. Really kind of amazing.
No, I mean, you switch back between Daryl and Doc and you show them both in the present tense, which has certainly a heartbreaking implication when you compare it to the stories that they tell you, again, with a frankness that is pretty stunning. And I'm curious, when you went into this, was there a player that you idolized growing up that you were particularly looking forward to trying to get to open up?
Well, yes. I was a Daryl guy in the 80s. Mm. And I remember, and it's interesting because I when the Mets draft a player and you're 15 years old and his name is Daryl Strawberry, you just think, wait, what does that mean? Like, and everybody said, oh, he's the next Ted Williams. He's the black Ted Williams, you know. And then watching him progress through his career, and it was always such a struggle to be a fan of this guy because he was difficult. He was angry and snappy, yes, and moody and haunted, and also lovable and had a great smile, but, you know, clearly troubled. When Doc came along in 84, Dwight was so otherworldly and so good right from the start, and came from what we were all told was a stable middle-class background. And I had Met fans, you know, friends of mine who would say, oh, I'm a Doc guy. And I would say, Doc doesn't need me. Daryl needs me, you know, in the way that as a fan, you know, say things like that. We started the production, then the pandemic hit. And we had to scramble. And from then on, we just did these interviews remotely, where I would be zooming in from my office in New York City and interviewing Lenny Dykstra in Southern California or Kevin Mitchell in San Diego or, you know, wherever. But Daryl, he lives in suburban St. Louis, and Daryl was the one flight I made.
Mm.
I didn't come all of this far to not actually get to meet Daryl. And we spent, you know, I think it was an 8-hour interview. We started at 10 and finished at about 8 and probably an hour or two break in there. He could not have been more open or honest. I mean, he really has at last turned his life around. He's a preacher and he feels like if he tells his story honestly, it'll help other people. Doc is the same way. He wants to help people not make the same mistakes he made. And so I think that is a large reason why both those guys are willing to tell, you know, such deep and detailed stories about their backgrounds and some of the struggles that they went through.
And the other thing about seeing them in the archival footage that you present in your movie is just how young they were.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see, and again, it's you see them age on tape and you just think, of course, this was going to be difficult. Now, maybe no one foresaw exactly how difficult it became for them, but the idea that they were these characters, I mean, could not walk around the city. I wonder if the age, if the youth was staggering to even you as a fan of this team as you look at it in retrospect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was almost Dwight's age, but I mean, I hadn't accomplished very much by the age of 21.
Same.
When he is in his third major league season and, you know, only 17-6, you know, after the miraculous year of 85. Yeah, their youth, especially when you look back now at all the temptations that lay at their feet in the city in the mid-80s, you know, how could a 21-year-old or a 24-year-old with no support system?
Yes.
It was a different time. It was like, hey, you're a grown man, you're an adult, you know, go out on town, do whatever you want.
And that was part of, as you say, that was part of like Davey Johnson's philosophy, right? For better and for worse, the idea that, hey, you guys produce, I'm not going to be a hall monitor in your lives.
Right. No, he wasn't their babysitter and he didn't think it was his job. You know, so long as you show up and you produce, whatever you do on your own time to get you ready for the game, so long as you're ready, that's fine. The problem is these guys just didn't have anybody. Although Daryl does say that his mother told him, you know, I wish you would stop drinking and carousing around with girls. I wish I would have listened to my mom.
Yeah.
But it is sad. It's sad as a Mets fan that they didn't win more. And it's sad what happened to both of them. But on the other hand, you look at the numbers, they both had pretty darn good careers for a while.
Mm.
You know, even when they were carousing, they were producing. I mean, Daryl as a Met, you know, he still has the home run, you know, three of his next 4 years after 86 were terrific.
It says something, I feel, Nick, when the guy that is nicknamed Mr. Perfect, Ron Darling, went to Yale, you know, handsome, well-read, book at the locker, all of that. Even that guy went to jail during the 86 season?
Yeah. You know, I think Gary Carter and Mookie Wilson were the two guys who really didn't carouse. You know, 20 of them would go out to dinner together. And then, you know, two of them would go back to the hotel, Gary Carter and Mookie Wilson, and the rest would go out on the town. They were all in it together. It was a brotherhood. You know, they were a family.
It's party time at Shea.
A win by the New York Mets tonight, and they would be champions of the Eastern Division of the National League. And the crowd is really fired up.
This family arrives at September 17th, 1986. It is Cubs at Mets. It is the NL East on the line. Doc Gooden is on the hill. What's this scene like at Shea Stadium?
It's such a great scene, and we were really lucky enough to get some fans who had brought their newfangled camcorders to the game. And so we have some fantastic fan footage. It's never been seen before. And it's insane what happens when the last out is made.
The pitch on the way. Ground ball to the right side of the infield. Backman has it. To Hernandez. Let's win. It's over. And oh, my goodness, the fans are storming the field.
10,000 fans are on the field within a minute. One of the Mets is overheard on some of the footage saying they swarmed the field like bees. And the Mets were scared. You know, somebody grabbed Hernandez's hat, but they didn't get his glove.
This kid came up and grabbed my glove and tried to take my glove. And I looked at him and I went, oh, okay, okay.
But he had to, you know, stare down a fan to hold onto his glove. It's just like almost like a riot. It's the one time Sandy Carter, Gary's widow, told us, it's the one time she lived in New York City that she was actually scared of New York City.
Bodies rolling down on top of the screen above us. I think that's the only time I really was afraid of New York.
It's just a raucous, wild celebration that you don't see anymore.
No, I mean, there's a lawlessness there, Nick. I mean, when the ball is approaching Keith Hernandez, you can see people already putting feet onto the infield dirt. Like, it's wild.
It is wild. And it's the sort of culmination of that summer of wildness. It felt like at any minute that summer, anything could happen, for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. It was unruly. And it was another one of these moments where the city and the team just sort of fused together.
Okay, coming up, why the wildest part of that entire 86 playoff run happened on a plane.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So So, Nick, the Mets, they get ready to take on the Astros in the NLCS. And there is real subtext to the Mets and the Astros dynamic, both on the field and very much off of it. So what was the relationship between Houston and the Mets as you saw it?
Well, the fascinating thing was that four Mets had been arrested earlier that season in Houston at a Houston nightclub after scuffling with off-duty cops.
And Friday was a bad night all the way around for the Mets.
Four players accused of being involved in a free-for-all
off-duty with some off-duty police officers Houston at Cooters cops. Nightclub in Southwest
Houston. Tim Tuffle and pitchers Ron Darling, Bob Ojeda, and Rick Aguilera all spent the night in jail.
So Houston had a personal reason to hate the Mets as they came into the Astrodome for that first game of the series. And then you have Mike Scott, who is in 86 the best pitcher in the league because the Mets think he cheats.
Scuffball Scott, I call him.
They would be scuffed in the same spot, like chicken scratches.
And the ball was moving like crazy. It's like a wiffle ball coming at 90 miles an hour. You know what it's going to do.
And the scuff made Scott both unhittable and also he got in the Mets' heads in a way that few players get in the minds of their opponents. They seemed more obsessed with catching him cheating than actually hitting him. And before you know it, he's beaten them in game one. He's shut them out. And they're in the hole. The other interesting thing I think about Mike Scott is that he had been a Met in the early 80s when they were terrible and he was terrible. So it wasn't after he left the Mets that he both learned the split finger fastball from former original Met Roger Craig and then started, you know, according to the Mets, started scuffing the baseball.
Yeah. Astros cheating allegations, Nick. Just one of many resonances that this film has to the modern day.
Yes. Exactly.
But let's fast forward to game six here, Nick, because the Mets are up 3-2. They are extraordinarily desperate to avoid game seven because that is where their nemesis, Mike Scott, and all of his alleged scuffedness, that's where he would be pitching. And so the Mets send Bobby Ojeda, their starter, to take the mound. And what happened?
Well, Ojeda had arm trouble all season long that he was battling through, and it came to a head before game six. So before the Mets fly to Houston, he has to jump on a plane, go down to Washington, get a shot in his elbow from the team doctor who was down at a conference in Washington, fly back to New York, then get on the team plane, fly out to Houston. And as he says, like he couldn't get loose. You know, he felt like there was a sandbag in his elbow. And before you know it, the first inning goes to hell and he's given up 3 runs. And then finally, he's sort of able to work the kinks out and he keeps the Astros at bay for 5 innings. But the Mets can't do anything against Bob Nepper, their lefty ace. And they go into the 9th inning, down 3-0, facing the inevitability of Mike Scott the next day. And according to them, the inevitability that they wouldn't be able to beat him. And that's when Davey Johnson does one of these brilliant managerial moves that you would not see today, where he goes on gut instinct, not analytics, and he selects Lenny Dykstra, a left-handed hitter, to lead off the 9th against left-handed pitcher Bob Nepper. And Dykstra hits a triple and sparks a game-tying rally, and you go into extra innings, and then begins the real drama of that wonderful 16-inning game that many people have said is the greatest game ever played.
Yeah, and just to get you on the record, is it the greatest game ever played in your mind?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's got to be up there. Given the pressure of the game, it was sort of unprecedentedly pressure-packed. And what also made it great as a New Yorker was the city came to a standstill. Everybody, it was an afternoon game, so it was time to, you know, go home and leave the office and stuff. And nobody went home. Like you gathered at a bar or you looked through a store window, and the whole city just was hypnotized by this game.
I came up to pick up my mom from work and I was listening to her on the radio and I see the TVs in the window. Figured I'd catch the end of the game about an hour and a half ago.
What happened to your mom?
Oh, she's still waiting for me to go out to dinner.
There again, in all of the awfulness and the darkness of the 80s, there is a romance, Nick, to the scene you're describing just now here.
Yeah, there's something, you know, that now seems kind of innocent about it all. Roger Angel and Chuck D, who could hardly be more different.
What a pair, by the way.
Yeah. You know, both telling us stories about, you know, seeing these people wino, you know, crowded around a radio, or, you know, people looking in the limousine where they've got a little, you know, primitive television in the limo. It is amazing how everybody in the city just stopped what they were doing because of what happened in the World Series. I think game six of the playoffs has been, you know, I don't want to say forgotten, but it tends to get overlooked.
Yeah. If anybody wants to know how thorough this film is, both 100-year-old Roger Angel, the dean of baseball writers, longtime writer for The New Yorker, and the head of Public Enemy are both very much in this film, sharing remarkably, yes, remarkably sympathetic opinions. So after this game, Nick, whether or not it's the greatest ball game ever played, the flight back to Queens feels like maybe one of the most infamous post-game flights that has ever been. I've heard some about this, but I need you to walk us through what happens and what that's like.
Well, you know, it's become a part of myth, this airplane ride back from Houston, and what the Mets did or didn't do to that airplane and on that airplane, and what was consumed, you know, by whom and when and why and who did it. It's just one of these things we'll never know the full story. But it's safe to say there was a lot of alcohol and there was a lot of cocaine and there was a lot of vomit and there were a lot of seats that were broken. Is it true, as Sid Fernandez tells it, that by the time the plane landed, there weren't any doors on the plane anymore? I don't know. But it has become the thing of myth. And then the aftermath, also part of the legend, is like, well, how much was the bill?
$5,000 worth of damage to the plane.
$10,000 worth of damage to the airplane.
There was $18,000 in damage.
$150,000.
Whether or not it's true, what actually happened on that airplane, I doubt we'll ever really know. I doubt any of them even remember. But it's certainly a fun part of the story.
Yeah, it does feel like the witnesses involved here are all unreliable by virtue of their own participation in that flight.
Exactly. Oh, well said, Paulo. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, look, they make it to the World Series. They are facing the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox are coming to town. They're coming to Queens to face the Mets. At that point, what did people tell you about the mood of the fan base and the entire city?
Well, the fan base had been whipped up into a frenzy, you know, the whole summer. The mood at Shea Stadium those first two games was shut down pretty quickly because the Mets weren't hitting. There was definitely, if not a literal, at least a metaphorical hangover after the series in Houston. That series drained them. And the next thing they know, they're down 2-0 and they've dropped the first two games at home to the Red Sox. And it's almost like they didn't wake up until after that point. Mm. And I think that the city, you know, people who went to those first two games, it's like, yeah, it was kind of dead. It was kind of flat. It was weird. I actually went to game one, and I remember my father and I scalped tickets, the worst seats I ever had in my life. And we're driving out, and I remember listening on the radio, and Bob Murphy described the atmosphere at Shea as being somewhat flat that first game. Maybe the fan base had a hangover too, or we all just thought, well, the World Series will be a cakewalk after the Houston series, which was so white knuckle the whole way through.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, the ball rolling through Bill Buckner's legs, that's the moment that I hope everybody listening to this, they know chapter and verse about that already. We don't need to go through the blow-by-blow of the Red Sox almost breaking the curse of the Bambino and then Bill Buckner, all that stuff. I hope we know that. But I'm very curious, the people that you interviewed about that series, but really that moment in their lives, how do you describe what they told you?
You know, it's kind of amazing, given that we're just memorializing the 20th anniversary of 9/11, everybody remembers where they were. And it's such a bleak, unhappy memory, but it's emblazoned. You can't forget it, even if you wanted to. The flip side of that is the wee early morning hours of October 26th, 1986. Mm. Everybody remembers where they were. Even Red Sox fans, it's also a bleak thing. And people who aren't baseball fans, the electricity of that magical comeback, a miraculous comeback against the Red Sox, which you know, it wasn't all on Buckner. They got three hits, and Stanley threw a wild pitch that Gedman easily could have corralled before the ball went through Buckner's legs. But somehow that series of events, 16 pitches that could have ended the World Series, like, it was such a miracle. It was so incredible. It was so indelible that all these years later, not only do all the Mets obviously remember their feelings about it, but so many people from around the world remember it. And we reached out to everybody and start episode 4 with a montage of people remembering it from all over in different walks of life, what they were doing, because it was another of these moments where this city just blended into the team, and it was like the culmination of a love affair. I don't know any other way to describe it, yeah. But it was a miracle, and they all remember it, and it changed, you know, it changed a lot of people's lives.
Is that feeling, Nick, that you just described there, that everybody told you about in ways that were unanimous and staggering in their unanimity, how much they all remembered where they were, is that the sort of feeling that satisfies a person, or is that the sort of feeling that you end up chasing as a Met fan for the rest of your life again?
Oh, wow. Well, you do chase it, and you want that magic to happen, you know, again and again and again. But, you know, you can't step in the same river twice. And it would be nice if the Mets at some point would just become a steady, normal franchise that, you know, every once in a while wins a World Series that isn't, that it has to be tinged with magic. You know, there was nothing particularly magic about the Dodgers' victory in the World Series last year. It was remarkable, and the pandemic and all that. Yeah. But, you know, teams win the World Series every year. It doesn't have to be so, you know, miraculous. You beat the Orioles the same year man lands on the moon, you know. I mean, it's just, it would be nice if there was something normal about the New York Mets, and maybe there never will be.
Nick Davis, thank you for telling me the story of a team and a city that I wish I had experienced too.
Well, thank you, Pablo. This was so much fun to talk to you. Thanks so much.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.